new three-part series on Chana and Prophet, or Prophet and Fighter. I have different versions of this title in different places. It is planned as a three-week mini-series taking us to the end of January. God willing, our February series will be a little bit longer. I think I planned it as a five-week series. That will be on Jews and food, which is revisiting a topic that we did like 9 years ago. So I think it's time for us to see that one with new eyes. But for now, we're talking about Chana, the biblical Hannah. As always, I do plan to record audio and to upload it and send out a follow-up email with a link for the recording for those who couldn't make it or just want to hear the greatest hits. The source sheets I send out in advance. And for anyone who is new here, please make sure that you register so that you'll be able to get the source sheets in advance and get the follow-up emails afterwards. This series is sponsored by Rhoda Waxman to honor the memory of her grandparents, Robert and Ida Kurtz, Zichronim Levracha. Thank you, Rhoda. Actually, one note of introduction that I think I do have to mention first. Going back, this is now when I came to my second synagogue. So this would have been 2001. I gave a class on the book of Joshua, Yehoshua. And I presented an overview, we had a discussion, and it was all very nice. And I really enjoyed the group. It was, you know, like our group here, it was a very broad group in terms of people's knowledge of Torah coming in and in terms of their background in Judaism. And after the class, a woman came up to me and said, you know, I really enjoyed the class. There's only one thing. Every time you said Yehoshua, I had to take a second in my head to translate that to Joshua. She knew Yehoshua equals Joshua, but it, you know, it needed to actually make that shift every time, and it threw her off and made it harder to follow. So I tried to be careful to use the English versions of the names. And that's why I titled the class The Biblical Hannah. But Hannah and Chana are the same. We're talking about the same person. So if I stumble and say Chana at some point, I mean to say Hannah. If I write Chana on the source sheet at some point, I apologize. I mean to say Hannah. If it's, you know, causing a problem, please let me know. They're the same. The name itself comes from a word which you may be familiar with. It's a Hebrew word, makes it into Yiddishisms. The word is chen. Chen means favor. What exactly does favor mean? Not favor like asking somebody for a favor, but to favor somebody. So Noah is introduced to us in the Torah with the statement that Noah found chen in the eyes of God. He found favor in the eyes of God. And that's the message with the name Hannah. It means somebody who is favored, and we generally understand, you know, favored by God specifically. And that's who we're going to be talking about for these 3 weeks, is a woman by the name of Hannah and her experiences, her identity. And I started us out on the sheet with source number one, a passage in the Talmud talking about Hannah's prayer for a child, in which Rabbi Elazar said, Hannah launched words heavenward. Now, the term launch, don't think space shuttle. That's not what we're talking about. Launching here, as it's used in the Talmud, refers to shooting an arrow. She shot words heavenward. She was attacking God when she prayed for a child. As the biblical verse says, she prayed upon God, meaning it was an attack. It was aggressive. This teaches that she launched words heavenward. In the Hebrew, it's vatitpalel chana al Hashem. Not la Shem, not she prayed to God, but al Hashem. She prayed upon God, against God. The Talmud depicts Hannah as aggressive, as angry. And what I want to do today, first we're going to go through the basic story, But I want to understand more about what fuels Hannah in her fight with God and see how God responds. That's what I want to understand Hannah as a fighter. Overall, just roadmap of the series, I want to start out with her as a fighter, then move into talking about Hannah as an architect of the way we pray. The Talmud uses her prayer as a model for how every Jew is supposed to pray. What does that mean? And then finally wrap up the series by talking about Hannah as a prophet, because she is recognized as one of the prophets in Tanakh, and I want to know what exactly that means. What was her prophecy? What did she predict? How does all of this fit together? Okay, are we clear on the mission here? Great. I gave you on the sheet in source number 2, and I see more people just joined, so I'm going to have to chat again for that. In source number 2 on the sheet, I gave you a link for classes I've taught on the book of Samuel. Hannah's story appears in the beginning of the book of Samuel. If you want to know more about her story and about the text itself, that's a class that I give Thursday afternoons. Some of the people here actually participate in it. It is a women's only class. My apologies to the males. I have actually a male class on Samuel also, which is basically a review of what we did in the female class. They're behind. The female class is up to chapter 23. The male class started later and is only up to chapter 10. But everyone's welcome to join that. Those are free classes. If you want more information about it, just let me know. But if you want more about her story than we're going to cover in our mini-series, that's the place to go. So, questions and comments before we start, because I'm about to tell the story of Hannah as an introduction to all of this. But anything before we launch in? Okay, then let's start. So, background. This story takes place a little more than 3,000 years ago in the land of Israel. After the Jews entered into Israel, they came out of Egypt, they spent 40 years in the wilderness, they enter the land, they are led by Joshua for 28 years, and then you have the period of the judges that lasts for a few hundred years. This story takes place at the very end of the period of the judges. The judges are individuals who lead the Jews. It's unclear from the text whether they are regional leaders or whether they're leaders of all the Jews. It sounds like they're more regional, but there's a lot to be said about that another time. We spent time last year, you'll recall, learning the story of Samson. Right? Ring a bell? So Samson was the last of the judges to be recorded in the book of Judges. He's the last one to be named, and this is right after his time. Now, who was Samson's main enemy besides himself?
The Philistines.
The Philistines, correct. The Philistines were his main enemy, and they continue to be the main enemy of the Jews during the story of Hannah. The Jews are living under domination by the Philistines. Now, the Jews had a central place of worship, which is going to feature in a big way in our story. That place is known in Hebrew as the Mishkan, the place where God will reside. In English, they usually call it tabernacle. I'm not 100% sure that's actually English. If someone had to ask me, what is a tabernacle, I would say it's a mishkan. But that's the word that they use. The tabernacle was located in a place called Shiloh. Shiloh is in the portion of the land of Israel assigned to the tribe of Benjamin, just north of Jerusalem. So, this central site, unfortunately, fell into disuse during the period of the judges. Religiously, a lot of the people started to blend Judaism with the idolatry of the Canaanites and the Philistines around them. So that in the entire book of Judges, which is a book with, if I remember correctly, 21 chapters, we only find one story in which Shiloh, the Mishkan, this tabernacle, actually features. It's only mentioned by the figures in the story once. That story is a tragic story in its own right and really worthy of its own mini-series. Sometime if you really want to be miserable and horrified by something in Tanakh, we could do a mini-series on that story. It's the story of the concubine at Giv'ah. I'm not going into the whole story right now. But at the end of the story, they talk about a festival that went on at this tabernacle in Shiloh. If you take a look at source number 3, where one figure in this story, one person in this story, is trying to explain to somebody about the festival that's going on in Shiloh. So, and they said, there is a festival of God in Shiloh annually, north of Bethel, east of the road that ascends from Bethel to Shechem, and south of Livona. Now, don't worry, I'm not asking you to draw a map. That's not required in this course. But what jumps out at you when you read this description? A party in this story is trying to describe to somebody else a festival that's happening in Shiloh. What jumps out at you here? Yes, Janine.
Geographic location of it.
Right. You have to give somebody directions. This is how you go to get there. This is supposed to be the central place for Jewish religious worship. You're not supposed to bring sacrifices to God anywhere but in this location. They're also not that far. The people who are having this conversation are not at all far from Shiloh. It's basically next door from where they are. And yet, you have to have a description of, it's in Shiloh, there is an annual festival, so somebody's going there, right? That exists. But it's north of Bethel, east of the road that goes from Bethel to Shechem, south of Livona. Like, there's something wrong if people need that level of directions in order to find it. That's something that's worth knowing. So Shiloh was not, I believe, one of the Levite cities. It was the center where the Mishkan was, and therefore you had Levites who were there. But I'm not so sure that it's one of the Levite cities. You think it is? Okay. It's possible that it is. There were 42 of them, so I don't mind if I'm not remembering correctly. But that's something that's really important to know, is that this tabernacle, this Mishkan, is being used rarely by people. That's number one. Number two, a second element in the fact that this Mishkan has fallen into disuse is that we learn at the beginning of the book of Samuel that the Mishkan is being run by people who are using it as their private playground for their personal satisfaction and their personal enrichment. It's not going to figure in a big way into our story. It actually comes up in the second chapter in the book of Samuel, and our focus is going to be on the first chapter. But Eli is the name of the high priest, the Kohen Gadol. He is already older when we get to him in this story. He will die at the age of 98 after having been himself a shofet, a leader, a judge for 40 years. In his career, and we're somewhere towards the tail end of that career we know exactly how far along we are in his career, because he's somewhere in the 90 range at this point. And he has two sons. His sons are Hophni and Pinchas, and they are the ones who are running the tabernacle. And they use it, as I said, for self-enrichment. They abuse the people who come to bring sacrifices. And the description that the text gives is especially harsh in describing them. It talks about them abusing the women who have come to bring sacrifices. There's a lot of discussion as to what that meant, what exactly they were doing. But the point is, that's a great way to turn people off of the Mishkan. If the Mishkan has become this private preserve of people who are abusing people who show up there, why would anybody want to go? That's the second element here. And third, we're going to find in our story that Hannah is going to go to the Mishkan, and she is going to have a one-on-one conversation with the high priest Eli, who is just sitting at the entrance to the tabernacle. And that broadcasts to you, this is somebody with time on his hands. He's not busy. Now, in part, that's because his sons are the ones who are running the show. But it also says you have ease of access because it's not a very active business at this point, so to speak. So you get the picture here? This tabernacle that's supposed to be the height and the focus of our religious service was largely not at that stage. That's background for the story we're about to read. Okay? Good? Questions? Comments? Okay. Then let's see the story. Take a look at source number 4 on the sheet, please. The beginning of the book of Samuel introduces the family. This is my own translation. I was going to pull the translation, the JPS one, because there's so much text, but I didn't like what they did with some of the words, so I just did it myself. And there was a man from Ramatayim Tzofim, from Mount Ephraim. Note, geography is not going to be on the final, so don't panic. But there was a man from Ramatayim Tzofim from Mount Ephraim. Mount Ephraim is a central place in Tanakh. It's central in Israel, and a lot of things happen there. Most of the events in the book of Judges seem to happen in and around Mount Ephraim. It's not one mountain. It's a mountainous region. His name was Elkanah, son of Yeroham, son of Elihu, son of Tohu, son of Tzuf, an Ephratite. The term Ephratite has different meanings. Often it's understood to mean a noble, somebody of status. How else do you know from here that he has status? How do you know that he has status, that he's somebody of standing? Yeah, look at that lineage. Isn't that serious? I mean, how many names are we getting there? Elkanah, son of Yeroham, Elihu, Tohu, Tzuf. We're getting 5 generations here for this fellow. That is rare in Tanakh, and it generally denotes somebody whose ancestors we're supposed to know. This is a name of somebody of significance. So that's Elkanah. He had 2 wives. One was named Hannah. That's the one we're focusing on. And the second was named Peninnah, and we're going to talk about her as well. Peninnah had children. Hannah had no children. A couple of notes. First of all, just to help with the geography, because I didn't really give you much to work with. Ramah, or Ramatayim Tzofim, as it's called here, is north of Jerusalem, south of Shiloh. So it's in between. Basically, if you're journeying from Jerusalem to Shiloh, you will pass Ramah in the middle. Hannah and Peninnah are introduced as wives of Elkanah. Peninnah has children. Hannah has none. In a little bit, we will find out that Peninnah has sons and daughters. So it's not just like she has one child, but she has multiple children. There's an interesting nuance in the text, which the commentaries pick up on. He had 2 wives. One was named Hannah. The second was named Peninnah. You could read that just to say, well, we're listing the wives. However, commentators look at that and say, why did you have to number them when there are only 2? Why did you need to say 1 and 2? You could have just said he had 2 wives, right? You already did say that. He had Shtei Nashim. And just say, Hannah and Peninnah. Why did you have to give numbers to it? And they suggest that the reason is because Hannah was the first wife, and she was the primary wife. However, she was unable to have children, and therefore he married Peninnah. Something that we see elsewhere in the Torah, right? Where else do we find somebody who had such an arrangement?
Abraham,
right. He marries Sarah. Sarah can't have kids. And so Hagar becomes a wife as well, and we know how well that worked out. So here you have two wives. One of them is the primary one, and then you have the other one who was brought in to be able to have children, and she was successful. We're going to come back to that dynamic. Right now we're just introducing the story. So we then move from our introduction of the family to an annual event. The following used to happen year after year. And that man ascended from his city annually to bow and to sacrifice to God, master of multitudes, in Shiloh. And there, two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, were Kohanim. They were priests for God. And on that day, when they would go up, Elkanah would sacrifice and give his wife Penina and all of her sons and daughters portions. So he would bring his sacrifice to God, and he would distribute to Penina. And as I told you, she has multiple kids. She has sons and daughters. All of them get portions. And to Hannah he gave a double portion, for he loved Hannah, and God had closed her womb. Right? He feels bad for her, and so he says, I'm going to give her extra. And her rival in Hebrew is tsara, antagonist, angered her greatly to make her thunder. In Hebrew, harima, the word ra'am is thunder, to make her thunder. For God had closed her womb. She wants to get her good and angry. And so he would do every year, Elkanah, when she went up to the house of God, then she would anger her, and she cried, and she did not eat, and Elkanah, her husband, would say to her, Hannah, why do you cry? And why do you not eat? And why is your heart upset? Am I not better for you than 10 sons? I'm not going to ask for a vote on how successful that comfort line is going to be. He's a male. He's trying really hard, okay? Give him some slack. So the dynamic is very clear here, right? They're going to the tabernacle. They're bringing sacrifices. Penina's angering Hannah for her childlessness. Hannah doesn't eat. She's upset. Elkanah tries to comfort her by noting his love for her. Let me ask you a question. Oh, Claudette, I'll take your question first. Go ahead.
I just noticed that his answer to his wife was more gentle than the answer Jacob gave to Rachel when
yes.
she was praying for him.
Yes, it is very true. Jacob's response to Rachel is entirely different. His response to Rachel is, what are you blaming me for? Right? God is the one who has done it. And he's criticized rabbinically for that response to Rachel. It's very true. This may not be successful comfort, but he's well-intentioned. My question to you, why are they going to the tabernacle every year? No one else is going. Why are they going? What's this about? Dahlia, you have to unmute. Trying to continue tradition. That's a very good thought. In other words, we're gonna demonstrate what we ought to be doing. Good. I'm gonna come back to that idea when we finish the story. That's a very important concept. One thing we know it's not. All right, Claudette?
Maybe because they had a strong belief in what should be going on at that temple.
Mm-hmm. Right. Good. So this is an attempt at engineering. In other words, we're gonna create something here. One thing we know it's not is the thrice annual pilgrimage, right? The mitzvah of Aliyah LaRegel, of going to Jerusalem, when it's ultimately in Jerusalem, but the idea of going for the three holidays may well apply in Shiloh as well. However, that's not what this is, because that would have been three times a year. This is some kind of annual thing that's different from that thrice a year practice. Could be he's going four times a year, but we're focusing on this annual one. Yes, Moish. You're muted. idea. It's an interesting idea, and it's certainly found in, as you say, the Canaanite cultures, right? Baal, Ashtarte, you know, like that's, that they're built on that. But I would argue the point regarding Judaism, because while we do find that God is credited with causing children as well as causing inability to have children, we don't find, and correct me if I'm wrong, any rituals in Chumash targeted towards producing a child or beseeching God for a child. We have sacrifices for all sorts of purposes. I don't recall one about having children.
But there's one simple word that you have to keep in your mind throughout Shofti and everything, and that is the word syncretism. Syncretism
right.
is the notion of taking the best of every religion, and how would it be bad to go to the tabernacle, as other people pronounce it, for this purpose? And it would be a great thing, rather than going to Ashtaroth or some other Baal.
I agree with you, and that's, I made the point about syncretism before. I don't know if you were on yet, that did go on. But I'm speaking to the idea that within Judaism, this should have been found, the idea of fertility associated with God and with ritual. From a Jewish perspective, it wouldn't have been there. But it's true that syncretism has made it in. I don't think syncretism would have, we don't find in Elkanah's family, Elkanah, Hannah, Penina, any real sign of it. But let's go further. We have an annual event in which they go to the tabernacle. We now understand what's going on. Sacrifices are happening. They may be trying to push an agenda by going annually. We're going to come back to that idea that we just mentioned. But Penina is angering Chana, and I want to talk about that one. I'm just not there yet. So let's go through the story and see what happens on this special year. And Chana arose after the meal in Shiloh, and after the drinking, everybody's done with their food. And Eli the Kohen, the priest, was sitting on the chair beside the doorpost of the sanctuary of God. The chair, commentators suggest, was a special seat. It was specifically his chair. It comes up a couple of times in his narrative beyond this particular story. It'll show up later on. She was of bitter spirit. He marat nefesh is the Hebrew. She prayed to God, and she cried greatly, and she swore a vow, and she said, God, master of multitudes. Note, that's the second time that this name for God has shown up in the story. Master of multitudes, in Hebrew, the word used is Tzivaot. It's one of God's names. We don't usually pronounce it other than for liturgy or education. We usually would say Tzivakot or something rather than declare it because it's a special name of God. But it means master, right, so master of multitudes is the translation I prefer. I often see what Diane just said, Lord of hosts. I don't like it because I don't really understand it. I get what it means, hosts, not meaning a host the way it's used colloquially, but meaning multitudes. That's the word tzava in Hebrew means what? Sorry?
Army.
Right, so we often use it to mean an army, but it isn't really a word for army. It's a word for large groups of people who are or large groups of entities who are organized together. So the Slavadis are called Tziva HaShamayim, right? The hosts of heaven or the multitudes of heaven. That's why I translate it as master of multitudes. You could do Lord of hosts just as easily. So she says to God, master of multitudes, if you shall surely see the torment of your maidservant, surely, because it's a double verb in Hebrew, ra'o tir'eh, if you shall surely see the torment of your maidservant, and you remember me, and you do not forget your maidservant, and you give your maidservant the seed of men, if I'm going to have a child, I will give him to God all the days of his life, no razor shall ascend upon his head. What is the idea of no razor ascending upon his head? What does that mean to you? Yeah?
Nazir
is what it sounds like, right? Dedicating him as a Nazirite. Who else do we know who got dedicated as a Nazir?
Samson.
Samson. Right? We had a lot of discussion about that when we did the Samson series last year and what the purpose of that dedication was. Keep that in mind. And as she prayed at length before God, and Eli watched her mouth, and Hannah spoke upon her heart, only her lips moved, but her voice was not audible. And Eli thought she was intoxicated. And Eli said to her, and this is what I mean when I say there's this conversation going on. Eli's got nothing better to do. He's just watching this woman praying at the tabernacle. Eli said to her, how long will you be intoxicated? Remove your wine from yourself. And Hannah replied, saying, no, my master, I am a woman of bitter spirit. I have not consumed wine or intoxicating drink. I poured out my soul before God. Do not think your maidservant an evil woman, for out of my sorrow and anger I have spoken until now. She says, I'm not intoxicated, I'm bitter, I'm suffering. That's the way to read my mood. We have a phrase that appears in Tanakh and it gets used in liturgy. It's a beautiful phrase in the Hebrew, shechurat velo miyayin. Intoxicated, but not from wine. That's her state. And Eli accepts what she says. I'm just going to finish the paragraph and then I'll take comments. And Eli replied saying, go to peace and may the God of Israel give you your request that you have requested of God. And she said, may your maidservant find favor in your eyes. And the woman went on her way and she ate and she was no longer of that face, meaning she was no longer expressing that bitterness. And they arose early in the morning, and they bowed before God, and they returned, and they came home to Ramah. And Elkanah knew his wife Hannah, and God recalled her. Recalled, remembered, and it means that she is going to have a child. I saw Claudette, you had a hand up.
I'm trying to understand what she was doing, because I thought that when people went down there, they just took sacrifice, and the Kohen him were the ones who took the sacrifice from them. So she was praying to God in a place that she only went down to take sacrifice, right?
So that's an interesting point. Thank you for asking about that. The tabernacle was not, and the temple in Jerusalem was not, exclusively a place of sacrifice. We also have a tradition that the Sanhedrin, the high court, convened in the tabernacle and then in the temple in Jerusalem. I think you're in the class where we were learning about Yoav when he ran to the tabernacle and the whole idea there that the high court was there to hear cases. So that's another function. And you had prayer. You had rituals that were non-sacrificial that went on there. On Yom Kippur, there was the public reading of the Torah that went on there. So there were ritual purposes beyond sacrifice. There is a concept I know that some have that Judaism was sacrifice-based, and then when the sacrifices stopped, that's when prayer began. But archaeology has proven that that's not true. We had synagogues before the end of the temple period, and we had rituals of prayer already biblically. We had that, you know, if you think back to the text of the Chumash itself, we have when you bring your first produce to the tabernacle and you have a prayer that you're supposed to recite when you bring it. There were numerous prayers that went on associated with the site where this was. So that's, so she would have known it as a prayer site as well. Even though you're right that the dominant laws of that place center around what you do in terms of bringing sacrifices. That would be my understanding.
Yeah, isn't that what they say?
Well, that's the after sacrifice evolution. The idea that prayer will actually take the place of the sacrifice. Right.
Thank you.
Yep, sure. So what you're seeing here is that Hannah is distraught. She goes to pray. Parenthetically, she's not actually able to make this child a Nazarite via a vow. That doesn't work. A mother can't make the child a vow. in the story of Samson, Samson's mother also could not make him a Nazirite. We had a whole discussion last year whether Samson even was a Nazirite. That's a whole, topic in its own right. Eli misjudges her as being drunk. That misjudgment, there's a lot of material about why exactly Eli got it wrong. Also not the focus right now. Hannah is our focus. She defends herself. Eli gives her a blessing, and they go home. And God remembers her, right? That's key to it. Comments before we go into the next part? Yeah, Janine.
I'm just wondering, is it because her prayer was silent? What was it that struck it to ask that?
I think that's what the text picks up on, right? It says that... It specifies that only her lips moved, her voice was not audible, and Eli thought she was intoxicated.
Which means that until then, all prayers were said aloud?
That's what it seems like. That prayer would have been allowed until then. And that's consistent with what we're going to see, not this week, but hopefully next week, about the sages looking to her as a model and saying we should pray like her, which we do. Our Amidah is done in this style, modeled on what she did. Vanessa.
Yes, I'm curious about in English where it says, Eli, I replied, go to peace. It just seems like a strange, odd sentence. Usually we say, go in peace.
Good, thank you. Thank you for picking up on that. So in Hebrew, there are two phrases. One is lech l'shalom, and the other is lech b'shalom. Lech l'shalom means go toward peace. Lech b'shalom is go in peace. And it's true that people often in English will say go in peace. However, the Talmud actually teaches that the better phrase to use when speaking to the living is go toward peace. And the idea is, they base it on the fact that there's a particular case in Tanakh in which somebody wishes somebody else go in peace and that person dies. But the concept behind it is that we're supposed to go towards peace not having achieved it. It's a goal. But one only actually achieves it when they're done in this world. So when someone has passed away, we say of them, Lech b'shalom v'tanuach b'shalom, go in peace and rest in peace. And may you rise for your lot at the end of days. That's for someone who has passed away, but for someone who is alive, we wish them go to peace. I've had people who like to sign their emails, lech b'shalom, right? They're not usually lech, but they write b'shalom. I say, you should say l'shalom. That's, at least when you write to me. But that's where that is. Etty and then Dahlia.
I have a problem with her praying for a child. Somebody wants a child so badly, it's to have, to love, to nurture, to see them grow up. And she wants so bad a child that she's giving it away. What's the purpose of that?
Excellent. Excellent. We have to get there, but you've asked the question of questions. You're so adamant that you want a child, but you don't. So what exactly is it that she's doing here? Very good. I'm not answering you yet, but that is the question we need to address. Dahlia.
Good question. What tribe is she from, Hannah?
Don't know. Do not know. It's a good question. We don't know her lineage. We know Elkanah's lineage. We don't know hers. That's not so surprising, because in Tanakh, when a man and woman get married, they both are in the tribe of the man's family. There are those who take Ephratite to indicate that he's from Ephraim. I've seen that reference. The problem is that his son Samuel is a Levi, which means he's got to be a Levi. So the answer is that they're Levites. But I'm just noting, I saw somebody, I think it was the JPS translation, I think it was one of those that led me to not use it, was the fact that they said of Ephraim, and that's just, that doesn't work. Claudette.
Maybe her desire for a child was not so much to grow the child up, but to show that she can produce it, that her womb is not barren.
Could be. I'm going to come back to it. I want to get through the story first before we start answering the question. Eddie, is this part of a story or? Okay, go ahead.
But the Levites were distributed among the other tribes, so there could be a Levite living at the part of Ephraim.
Absolutely. Right, no, that's consistent. That could well be. It's not Ephraim's land, but theoretically it could have been. This isn't Ephraim's land, this is Benjamin's land. Sorry?
They came to Benjamin's land from Ephraim's land.
No, from Yehuda. In other words, this whole story takes place between the land of Yehuda and the land of Benjamin. Judah and Benjamin, that's what we're dealing with. Ephraim isn't Ephraim territory, as far as I know. But Ruchama's point that it could be a Levite city is correct, because this is a Levite family. Okay, so let's continue in the story, please. We have the number 20, that's what we're up to. Towards the bottom of the first side. And it was after the annual circuit of seasons, and Hannah conceived and she bore a son. And she named him Samuel. For I either requested or borrowed him from God. You could translate it either way. It's the same word in Hebrew, she'elah. So, she'iltihu, it means I requested him of God or I borrowed him from God. Either way, the message is that he is from God. It's, you know, God has answered my plea. And the man, Elkanah, and his whole family ascended to sacrifice before God the annual sacrifice and his vows, right? They're going for that trip again. But Hannah did not ascend, telling her husband, until the youth is weaned and I will bring him, he will be seen before God and he will remain there forever. Hannah says, I am not ready to bring him yet. He needs to be weaned first. And her husband, Elkanah, told her, do as is good in your eyes. See that? He is a wise husband. Do as is good in your eyes, remain until you wean him, only let God uphold his word. What his word means is unclear. The commentaries debate what exactly that means, but generally it's understood. His promise that Samuel will grow up safely and healthily. The woman remained, nursed her son until she weaned him. And she brought him up with her once she had weaned him with three bowls, an ephah of flour. Ephah is a volume measure. And a flagon of wine. And she brought him to the house of God in Shiloh. And the child was young. And they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the youth to Eli. And she said, please, my master, by your life, my master, I am the woman who stood here with you praying to God. For this child I prayed, and God gave me my request, which I asked of him. And I have also lent him to God. Right, God lent him to me, I'm lending him back to God. For all of the days he shall be lent to God. And she bowed to God there. There's a lot to say on this text that we're completely skipping. Like the fact that lending him to God in the Hebrew is hu sha'ul l'ashem. He is sha'ul to God. And the first king Samuel was going to anoint is named Sha'ul. Like, there's a lot to be said, but like I said, go to the...
When the children left Egypt,
Shalui, Shamiru, all the Yeah, B'Sha'Allah, same word. So I refer you to source number 2, to that link for more, if you want to know more about this story. There are all sorts of avenues we haven't explored, but it's 45 minutes into the first session, and we just got her story down. By the way, just parenthetically, I hope people are aware, this story is also the Haftorah on Rosh Hashanah. Right? This is the first day of Rosh Hashanah, the Haftorah. So get your mouths out, make notes. Okay. So I said to you in the beginning that we're going to talk about Hannah as a fighter. And that is where I want to go with this. If you flip the page to the other side, or scroll if you have it on a screen. Source number 5. This is an imperative that God gives the Jews in the Torah portion of Terumah. We're actually going to be up to it in the weekly Torah reading in another couple of weeks. God says, and they shall make for me a sanctuary, and I shall dwell in their midst. I want a central site among the Jews where my presence will be located. That is the Mishkan. Mishkan, tabernacle, but Mishkan comes from the word lishkon, to reside. It's where God is going to dwell. They have that for 39 years in the wilderness. Then, because it's built in the second year. They then have 14 years when it's located in a place called Gilgal, where they first crossed the Jordan. Then 369 years in Shiloh, until these events that we're reading about, which happen at the end of that period of time. So you have now had a Mishkan at this stage for, you know, roughly 420 years, give or take. Not the same structure. Important to note, things changed about it. The vessels that are inside, you have the same requirements. You have the ark, you have the menorah, you have the table for the showbread, but the structure itself evolves. Then after this story, Shiloh is going to be destroyed. We're not getting to it, but in chapter 4 of the book of Samuel, Shiloh is destroyed by the Philistines. And then you have a new tabernacle in a city called Nov. That gets destroyed. Then you have one in a place called Gibeon, where it is, until Solomon ultimately builds the temple in Jerusalem. So, as I said before, nobody is going to the tabernacle these days. And the you know, chalk that up to the syncretism, chalk that up to the abuse from Hophni and Pinchas. But that's the way it is, and we saw it illustrated by the fact that people needed specific directions in order to know where it is and how to get there. So we now find Elkanah and his family taking their annual visit there. And I asked the question, what is the nature of such a trip? If it's for the festivals, it should be thrice each year. And if it's not for the festivals, then why are you going? So the simple read would be to say that Elkanah has taken vows, we referenced them, to bring personal sacrifices, so he doesn't want to wait, right? That's something that we see here. However, the rabbis commenting on the story saw what Etty saw and what Claudette saw, that this is engineering something. And this is actually the first fight that we associate with Hannah. In this case, it's Hannah and her family. And it's going to fit the career of her son Samuel. It is a fight to make the Mishkan, the tabernacle, relevant again. That's what this is about. Take a look at source number 6, please. A passage in the Jerusalem Talmud. They're building off of a verse in Proverbs, but I didn't bring the verse. I just brought you the rabbinic comment. Rabbi Zera said, if your nation has aged, rise and create a fence for her. Meaning, if it's falling apart a little bit, you need to lead. You need to do something to get people in line. As Elkanah did, leading Israel on pilgrimages. And they quote the verse, and the man ascended from his city. The sages are picking up on the fact that the verse said he ascended from his city. Where else would he have ascended from? Obviously he ascended from his city. Why didn't you just say, and the man ascended? By using those words, saying he ascended from his city, what you're trying to say is he would try to get other residents to go. He was trying to influence his community. This is an attempt to get people on board. Another one like that is in source number 7, a midrash on the book of Samuel, which says, and the man ascended from his city. He was elevated in his home. He was elevated in his courtyard. He was elevated in his city. He was elevated in all Israel, and all of his ascent was only due to himself. In other words, they're picking up on the fact that it is called ascending. It's called going up. Even though you're headed topographically, you're not necessarily headed up, right? You live in a place called Ramah. Ramah, by definition, is a height. You go down from the height in order to travel. Nonetheless, it's called going up, ascending in the text, because this was ascension. He's trying to go upward, and he's trying to do it with all Israel. He wants to try to bring people along. It's a remarkable idea. Fighting against the national trend. Fighting against what Hophni and Pinchas are doing in the tabernacle. Take a look at source number 8, please. Comment from Don Isaac Abarbanel. He says, before you see source number 8, go back to the first slide. Look at the text. The text described, I'm talking specifically about in the second paragraph in source number 4. So we have verse 3. The man ascended from his city annually to bow, to sacrifice to God, master of multitudes in Shiloh. And there, two sons of Eli, Hophni and Pinchas, were Kohanim, were priests for God. Tell me something. Why did you need to mention them? It has nothing to do with them. Why is it there? So now we flip back to source number 8, and Don Isaac Abarbanel offers us an answer. It's meant to teach that even though Hophni and Pinchas, the two sons of Eli, were in the temple and they were abusing people who came there, they were enriching themselves. Even still, Elkanah did not refrain from going there annually to bow and bring offerings, for he was concerned for the service of God. He was not concerned with the wickedness of the Kohanim, of those priests, in his great righteousness. They're going there despite the priests who are running it, right? You don't like the rabbi? They're going anyway. How do you like that? But more than that, this is a big deal economically, right? It's a big deal. You're leaving your home, leaving everything behind, in order to make this journey. Granted, it wasn't so far for him from Ramah. Nonetheless, it's a pain, right? Penina has sons and daughters. How much do you appreciate packing up all your little kids to go, schlep to the tabernacle? I don't know if she was in such a great mood. Maybe that affected what she did to Chana. It could be she was jealous a little bit. And then for Chana, this is a terrible event, reminding her every time that she has no children. They're distributing everything, and Penina's getting plenty, and Penina's mocking her for the fact that she doesn't have. That's terrible. The Talmud actually goes on at length, I didn't bring it, I should have brought it on the sheet, to describe the things that Penina would say to make her feel bad. It's just awful. Now, I see your hand rose, but I just wanted to note something, because when you look at sources 6 and 7 and 8, they emphasize Elkanah as the leader in them going to the tabernacle, right? You could argue this isn't really Hannah being a fighter, right? It's the family that's doing it, and Hannah's along for the ride. You definitely could see it that way. However, I call you back to the first side, source number 4, and the paragraph that starts with verse 9, in which you find that Hannah goes to pray there in the Mishkan, and she makes a very specific pledge. Look what Hannah pledged. We've already noted it, but I want to make sure that it's 100% clear. What did Hannah vow?
To give her son all his life. God.
Give him to God, right? And that meant, as it played out at the end of the passage, it played out in terms of bringing him to the temple there, the tabernacle there, and leaving him there. Nobody goes there, right? I mean, you have a vision for your son that he's going to grow up and he's going to thrive and all that, and you're bringing him to a place the nation has abandoned. Right? What are you doing? And the answer is, this is her fight also. The fight to make the tabernacle relevant. That's something that is Hannah's fight as well. And she is giving her son the most precious thing that she has, based on the way we read her in this story. She's giving her son in pursuit of making the tabernacle relevant. And this is our introduction to Hannah as a fighter. She and her family have a vision, and they stick to it. Okay, Rose and then Claudette.
I just wanted to say, to me, I see a lot of parallels between Hagar and Sarah and Nina and Hannah, because in actual fact, there are parts when Hagar actually had the baby, had Ishmael, she was arrogant, and she was aloof, and she tormented Sarah a little bit.
So we're going to come to that. That's the next fight. You're anticipating the second fight. But yes, very good point. Claudette.
You just said what I was hoping to say about Hannah taking her child to set an example for the people around them. But what I find beautiful about that closing statement about giving kids to God, it tells me that God, our kids are led to us by God.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's certainly the way that Hannah frames it. I think that's a little bit like, you know, that it's a model that's hard to live up to. It's not a small thing.
Because we want to own our kids and guide their lives and do everything.
It's hard.
But really, it's God who's led.
Right. And yet, when we get to her third fight next week, it's going to go back to the opening source that we saw. We find her expressing what looks an awful lot like anger towards God. So this relationship is going to be complicated. But that's her first fight. So we've read the story. We have a knowledge of what goes on. We've seen her first fight, the one versus the nation, to try to get the people to recognize the tabernacle as relevant again. We have 3 minutes left, so I'm going to use the 3 minutes. Her second fight is the one versus her rival, Peninnah. We need to understand the story. Why in the world is Peninnah doing what she is doing? Is she just a mean person? Is she just like a hateful person? I see Dahlia shaking her head. Yep. How else could you understand it? Etty, tell me.
Elkanah loves Hannah better than Peninnah.
Right. And therefore Peninnah is?
Jealous.
Right? She's hurt. Peninnah, in her mind, is a victim. And I think that's really important. I noted for you here in source number 9, the comment from Rabbi Meir Leibush Weiser, also known as Malbim, the idea that Hannah is the primary wife. He says, it didn't mention both of them with a definite object. The wife is Hannah. Teaching that he married Hannah first, and at first she was the only woman in the marriage, and then he married Peninnah as well. And the sages were correct in saying that when Hannah saw she could not produce a child, she counseled him, Elkanah, to take Peninnah as well. And perhaps Hannah would be built up through her, as Sarah did with Hagar, just like we've mentioned. And it fits so well, this jealousy, with the story. Take a look at go back to source number 4 and specifically the second paragraph. It's cause and effect. To Hannah, he gave a double portion, for he loved Hannah. And therefore, her rival angered her greatly. Right? It's cause and effect. Elkanah shows love for Hannah. Peninnah goads Hannah. And so it says she does it to make her thunder, to make her angry. Rashi says to make her miserable. That's one take. I saw a note in the chat using her, Peninnah, as a tool, and that is the second approach. And we'll just say it very quickly. I brought you the passage from the Talmud in source number 10, which compares Peninnah to the Satan, who is God's tool in order to achieve ends that seem unsavory to us. It says, Peninnah is altruistic. She's trying to inspire Hannah to thunder to God. She wants to help Hannah to pray. The idea is, if you look back at the sentence, if you look back at the sentence about what Peninnah did to Hannah, her rival angered her greatly to make her thunder, for God had closed her womb. It's identifying God as the cause. She wants Hannah to pray. Now, there's a lot to be said about this. It's a huge topic that we're not discussing, because this is a class about Hannah, not about Peninnah. But my point here is that Peninnah is angering Hannah, whether out of jealousy or whether as a tool of God, who's going to make her miserable in order to get her where she needs to go. But now that brings us to Hannah's reaction, and it's 11 o'clock. So rather than race through it, I'm going to come back to how Hannah reacts, her second fight, and then her third fight, and understanding what it means for Hannah to be a fighter, And then once we get through all of that, we have to move on to Hannah as an architect of prayer. So we got a lot to talk about. Thank you very, very much, everybody. I'll stay on for a few minutes for questions and comments. I really enjoyed being back together again. Some of you I haven't seen in a while, so I especially enjoyed that. And not that I didn't see you, but I'm seeing you. Let's be clear. But